This is The Film Effect with Tiff.
I'll be coming for her, and I'll be coming for you, too.
Sure you will, and I'll be waiting.
You are about to enter a world unlike any you've ever seen before, where rock and roll is king. The only law is a loaded gun. Where the beautiful...
Stay and see the show, it's really good.
The brutal...
I want Tom Cody.
And the brave all meet.
From now on, it's for real.
In Streets of Fire.
You're lying in your bed and on a Saturday night. You're sweating buckets and it's not even hard. But your brain has got the message and it's sending it out to every...
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome. Welcome inside the pod studio. I'm back in the studio again with a real live person in front of me, not just Zooming or Skyping or whatever new squadcasting. There's like a million
Zooming
platforms that people... We're not using cans, though, so that's good. The string in the can has not actually been effective for podcasting, although maybe children are trying that. I'm just dating myself. But welcome back, everyone. And I have a guest this week who has brought us back to the 80s with a really awesome blast from the past. And so his name is Rob Rector. Rob, say hello.
Hello. So, yes, thank you for having me. This is an awesome little studio, though. I get a nice little view of people dining.
Right? There's like a window.
Hopefully this doesn't pick up my stomach growling, but...
That's okay.
Yeah. I have long been a fan of films ever since Star Wars. That's the typical Star Wars geek. In fact, I think I even mentioned this on a previous podcast here that Star Wars was kind of the impetus for it. But that said, you know, there's a film that I continually go back to in the 80s because I was just a teenager or about to be a teen. I can't even remember. But I just remember this being a quintessential film. And during lockdown, it was one of the first films I was like,
it?
Yeah, it was like, this is a comfort food for me. Like, I was all about comfort. I just wanted to do, you know, the music that I listened to growing up, the movies that I watched growing up. I wanted that comfort. I wanted to be secure, you know, because it was just, you know, the world was on fire.
And, right.
You know, I wanted something initially just to kind of pacify. And I went to this film.
I love that you just said that. Real quick before, because we're already going to get in. So I'm going to say a few things. The movie is Streets of Fire. If you didn't guess from the opening, how dare you not know what this movie is. But second of all, Rob, why don't you just give a little plug for what you are. What you are.
What are I?
I'm sorry. I've not had enough coffee again.
A few things. It depends on the day.
Yeah, what do you do?
So I chair the communications department at Delaware Tech. Shout out DTCC,
Rob
Waters. You know, you've known many of the crew there. Let's see. I've been up until quarantine had been the film reviewer for the Cape Gazette for the past 15 years. A paid film reviewer. I got paid to go to the movies every single
Dude,
week.
You were living my dream.
So
job.
I know, and so many students have said the same thing. They're like, "How can I get a full time?" I'm like, "There are none."
No,
I was a dinosaur. I was one of the last. So I do still write for Film Threat, which is a it used to be a zine back in the day.
Oh my God, I love that.
Yeah,
so, I know exactly that magazine, and I used to buy it.
Is now an online incarnation of it, and I do film reviews. You know, they just send me screeners, and I review their films, and I do a podcast with a friend of mine called the AVOD. They do they're more horror specific. And then Rob Waters and I occasionally will put together a little cinematic sandbox that we hope others will come play in called the Revival House.
My favorite thing.
So, yeah, it's...
I love
it. You know,
it.
It's a fun little side venture that we had and, you know, at the Milton Theater. Of course, you know, the Milton Theater's obviously practicing its social distancing and everything, so we're limited as to what we're doing there. And we're waiting, actually, to wait for it to open up fully before mm-hmm. we kind of launch back to what we want to do.
Yeah, but you guys are doing Jaws Fest, and that is like...
So Jaws Fest is our big one coming up. It's the Hudson Fields later on in August. It's to benefit BB Medical Center. BB needs a bigger boat. So we are raising funds. It's completely free, open to the public, August 27th, I believe that is. It's a Thursday. It's that last Thursday. And it's open to the public. It's free. You know, we're going to have some live music there as well. We will have, a couple vendors. Everything's going to be social distanced. We have it's quote unquote, a drive-in, but you're not driving. It's, you bring your blankets and your beach chairs and whatever, and we're going to have it gridded out.
Spaced out.
Yeah, exactly. So that people will be, socially distanced and you have to wear your masks at all times.
But there's no body of water.
Fun fact.
I could not
book this film if it was in a certain distance of a body of water.
Did you happen to see my comment?
Yes, yeah.
I think that should be required, that it's in a body of water.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, what's wrong with this people?
It brings forth agita. Well, somebody even suggested, they're like, this is a great idea. You should have it floating. And they do in Europe.
Do they? I saw pictures of that. Yeah.
Where you actually get in like this tube with your food, drinks, whatever.
It's amazing.
And you sit, and sure enough, there is a big screen of Jaws, and you get to watch it in the comfort of a wading pool.
It's almost like 4D, if you think about it,
it is that way. Yeah.
Like you could literally be in the boat with them while they're sinking.
Exactly.
And
you have Richard Dreyfuss next to you.
I'm so excited for this event because I love that movie, and we're not talking about the movie, so I should divert.
It's okay.
But yeah, I just wanted you to mention all these things because I do have the people that do listen, I think, are into film and movies, or they wouldn't be listening to me. And then backtracking to what you were saying about this movie being your cozy comfort.
Yeah.
This is the film Effect. And I do like to ask people to pick a movie that has affected them. And I love that you mentioned it as like kind of like a, it's kind of like your warm blanket, when you feel
it's
stressed.
It's a pacifier.
It really is for me, too. Mm-hmm. Like, movies are that for me. Like, when I have a bad, anything, I'm just kind of like, I'm going to put my movies on.
I really miss the sociability of it. And we talk about this in my film class a
Do
lot.
You?
Is, I talk to students about what the future of film is going to be. Because even before the pandemic, box office was suffering. People weren't going to the movies as much for a variety of different reasons. That said, it is still one of our most accessible art forms that we have. If you think about it, not everyone has a favorite dance, not everyone has a favorite opera, not everyone has a favorite, museum that they go to, but you ask anybody and they all have favorite films. So, it is so accessible and is so prevalent in society, and it just, it leaks through every, facet. It's on our phones, it's on our laptops, it's whatever. And that art form, there's nothing better to me than going into a communal setting with a group of strangers, and you walk out and you have this shared experience. Now, you don't have to have the same experience at all, but it is a shared experience. So, and you can discuss it afterwards, and that's what I love. I founded the film festival here years ago, and that's kind of what we initially had the film festival for, is to be able to have people talk about these experiences that they had, these cinematic experiences that they had. I think it's really important, and it also brings us together and talks about just as much as our similarities as our differences. And
that's why I did this, because I went to film school, and you guys know I'm like a broken record, but I went to film school, and we would do that. It was like we would go to movies, we would sit around afterwards and have drinks and talk about them and get all of our feelings out. And so I was missing that after movie conversation. And I thought, well, I'm going to drag people into a room with me and make them talk to me.
That's right. At least it's a little bit lighter than a darkened theater right now.
And I haven't offered you a beverage of any sort.
I bring my own.
But that's okay, because here we are. It's kind of early.
Yep.
And I also love coffee, and I don't have that. I don't know what's happened today, but it's okay. We're off and we're... I'm so glad to have you. So Streets of Fire... And another thing about the cozy blanket or the, whatever your comfort movie is, comfort movie, that's going to be like my new term.
Yeah, it's a cinematic Twinkie. It's one of those foods.
Cinematic Twinkie. Oh my God, I love it so much. It's like the hot toddy movie. It's just whatever that is.
Yep.
I don't know what it is for me. What would that be? It's like coffee's my comfort. So maybe coffee and a movie. And I do think what's interesting about movies from your past is they kind of like... For me specifically, it's like a timeline of my growth as a person. Mm-hmm. So, like, I know if I like think about it being 10 and I think about a movie I loved when I was 10, it's like, that's who I was when I was, this is like what the person I was when I was 10. It gives me insight into myself as a young person. And I'm sure moving forward, it's going to have a different effect on me in terms of my age and my perspective and the eyes I am seeing with when I watch something now.
So fun fact, back before podcasts were even podcasts, this is back before I even, you know, kids came into the picture or anything. I started a little podcast called Natsukashi. Natsukashi, I love that word. That word, it's you can't translate it well into English, but the Japanese word essentially means history is not always as we recall it.
Mm.
And I really like that expression. And what I did was I took a film that we would watch in our youth, and I would have a certain guest on every single week. The theory was same movie, same person, completely different perspective.
Awesome.
And a lot of times we would have people who were involved in the making of these movies call in, and we would have them. So, like, let's say Beetlejuice, the guy who was the interior decorator in there, he was the real vivacious one. He called in.
Yeah.
He was great. He was also the mayor, the voice of the mayor in Beetlejuice. You know, we had several. I had one of the special effects artists of Star Wars on. I had, you know, somebody who worked with Mickey Rourke film, Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man, and you know, just all these random people who, Night of the Comet. I had the lead actress of Night of the Comet on, and there were all these films that we remember growing up, and we had certain memories, even if it was the events surrounding the film that we saw them.
Mm-hmm.
But they impacted us. They had some sort of impact on us. And then we watch them again as adults, and it's either, God, I can't believe I actually enjoyed that. Or oh my God, I never knew that. It's like watching Grease. When we watch Grease, I mean, because we're about the same age. So when we watch Grease growing up, we were like, oh yeah, you know, what? Go Grease Lightning. And then all of a sudden, you know, 10 years later, you're like, wait a minute. They were talking about chicks doing what?
I know.
You know? It was like, oh my God, this is so filthy.
I didn't know she was pregnant.
Yeah, exactly.
Bun in the oven. Yeah. Is that what that means? I'm so lost.
So it's a completely different perspective. And it was really fun. And I really enjoyed doing that. But, you know, kids ruin everything. So, you know, when kids came along, I just didn't have the time to really devote to it. But I enjoyed doing that because it was just as you said. I mean, it was something that we hold on to and we look at, and they're fun to revisit, whether it's for in regret or just in complete and utter comfort. You know, it's fun to go back and view them again.
It really is. And I think this happens a lot. So it's funny, we kind of have a similar thing, even though that wasn't my real thought when I started it. It was just like, let's talk about movies that make people feel things.
Yep.
And or they just like can't, they just rewatch them, you know, like you were saying. But okay, so that brings us to Streets of Fire, which I'm sure is this for you.
Yeah. You know.
So tell me about your pick and why you chose it.
I recall. Okay. So we talked about this a little bit off mic, but I was a geek. Yeah, am. And, you know, for Christmas, my parents would give me like the Leonard Maltin compendium of reviews and Roger Ebert's books of reviews. I mean, that's what I wanted for Christmas. That's what I asked for. And I would keep my own film journal. So I had this little, you know, spiral journal that I would keep all my film reviews in. And I remember giving this one 4 stars when I saw it, because this just exploded. It had everything. And Michael Paré, which we'll talk about him too, because Eddie and the Cruisers.
Oh my God.
And I was already in love with Eddie and the Cruisers because I was a huge Springsteen fan.
Okay.
So, you know, the John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band, and, you know, that's for those who might not know, you know, it was completely just a carbon copy of everything Springsteen, including, you know, having an African-American saxophonist
right.
play. So, you know,
right
down to it, but, you know, not quite as good. But it doesn't matter because it sounded enough like Springsteen that I loved it. So I loved Eddie and the Cruisers. And then Michael Paré came out with this film, which had neon in it, and it was set in this this nondescript time frame,
right?
And it was from Walter Hill, who was a favorite director of mine at the time, and he had a score by Ry Cooter. Ry Cooter is a He's a slide guitarist, and he plays like this blues guitar. He's come out with a ton of different soundtracks. And in fact, he did Buena Vista Social Club, which is a great look into the Cuban Cuban blues scene down in there.
I'm obsessed with Cuba.
Yeah, so he's a phenomenal, phenomenal musician. And he did the score of it, so it had this sliding guitar score to it. And it had guns, and it had explosions, and it had, you know, hot guys and cool chicks. And it was just, it just was this really weird, surrealistic fantasy world that, that for me, that's what typifies film. Film should just take you out of where you are and place you into an environment altogether different. And this was a world that was just altogether different for me, just as Alien would or Star Wars would. It just took you into this really cool place that you know, that you seldom, you know, you've seldom seen before. And that's, you know, that's what I loved about it. It had comedy, it had action, it had, you know, hard drinking guys and tough talking gals, and it was just, it was everything that was supposed to be cool to a, you know, a person just becoming a teenager. So anti-authoritarianism.
Oh, and, yeah, there's, you know, everything in this. So what I'm going to do is, I do this every episode. I'm going to give all my amazing listeners the stats or the basic information on this so you can find it, because I know you're going to run right out and rent it immediately. Streets of Fire was made in 1984. Director Walter Hill, writers Walter Hill and Larry Gross, stars Michael, and it's so funny, Michael Parr?
Perret. He had the accent.
I see the Perret.
Accent aigu over the E. So
he does. Yeah. It's very, he's like very, what's the word, exotic?
Cosmopolitan.
He is. Diane Lane, one of my, Rick Moranis. By the way, so many people are in this movie. Yep. You just don't even know what's coming around the corner.
Yep.
Like somebody opens the door and you're like, wait a second. Like you just can't even believe how many people are in this movie that you know.
Like the next one.
Willem Dafoe. I fucking love
Dafoe. One of his best roles still to this day. There was a scene in it that he, and you can see it in the trailer probably, but
yeah,
he's in these like leather overalls and topless, but just two straps on there. And he's still cut and his hair is like in this pompadour. And he just screams in the middle of a street, and it is the most frightening looking, you know, like visage that he's got. And it's just, it was terrifying. And they had a fight with sledgehammers, a sledgehammer fight. How awesome is that? That's so cool.
I have so much to say about this. This is going to be a long one. And he's like, he reminded me of Bowie a little bit. Like he had like a, he's just like kind of
androgynous kind
of. Yeah, but and Willem Dafoe does look like, he's such an interesting looking person anyway, and he plays so many different people, but he's like, he was so pale and just, he's like a vampire even.
Yep.
But there's like such a strong list of people in this. Amy Madigan, you know, Bill Paxton, the list goes on and on.
Deborah Vander.
That's right.
Yeah, she was in Too Close for Comfort. Yeah.
So many people. Yeah. So you just can let Ed Begley Jr.
Yeah.
I'm just reading now. I mean, just everyone.
Yeah.
Stoney Jackson. Okay, so I'm going to read. It's funny how IMDb will give you like the short version description and then the long. I'll just read the short so we can talk. A mercenary is hired to rescue his ex-girlfriend, a singer who has been kidnapped by a motorcycle gang, which is, it doesn't really give you much, but.
That's enough.
Do you think it's enough?
It's a rock and roll fable. Yeah. In fact, that's what it says.
One thing I will say, and you were right, and they do say this right away in the opening, is it's another time, another place. And so it is a time and a place that you don't know. And it does look like this weird mix of the 50s and the 80s.
Totally.
Which is purposeful because it says that here. And it's like meshing together 50s movies, greasers.
The cars all look like they're straight out of the 50s.
Totally. And in even the beginning, the motorcycle guys reminded me of like Marlon Brando in The Wild One.
Totally.
Like that hat, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's pulling from like, I don't even know. Like, there's just so many different things being like.
Even the cop cars had the big cherry top on them. You know, the siren on the top of it. And they had these big Studebakers. And I mean, you know, it was everything about it, it screamed it. But then in other scenes, it was like this bright neon and people were dancing out of a music video. And
it's like, and there are the bizarre. Long, there's a lot. I mean, I don't know where to start. It's interesting because I don't remember seeing this. I think I remember.
No one did.
not to bring up Eddie and the Cruisers, but we did, when we talked, we were like, oh, that's the other Michael Paré movie, that the one that I was obsessed with. Yeah. Probably because, and I've shared this before on here, like when your parents bring you into movies as a kid, like my dad was obsessed with Eddie and the Cruisers. And so he would just want to watch it, you know, and he'd be like, oh, we got to watch Eddie and the Cruisers, you know. So I became like also obsessed with watching that movie.
It was on HBO every other day.
Was it really?
Or, yeah, yeah. I mean, I didn't have HBO. We couldn't afford HBO, but my neighbor had it, and I was always over there watching it over and over again because that was one of the films. In fact, the reason why they have a sequel to that is because it bombed. I mean, it did nothing in the theater, and it completely, you know, it came and went. They pushed it back. It was originally supposed to come out in the summer, and they had a scheduling mishap and pushed it back to the fall. They wanted to hit the teen market, and it just missed it altogether. Also starring Ellen Barkin in that one.
Ellen Barkin. Yeah. Such a young Ellen Barkin.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I love it.
And Tom Berenger. It found new life with the song Dark Side, because it had it was at the top of Springsteen's game. So anything that sounded even remotely like Springsteen was a hit. So Dark Side came out, written, it sounds just like any other, you know, B-level Springsteen song. And that hit and did well. And then when it got released on home video and HBO, it resurged. I mean, everyone had, you know, a newfound interest in it. So
it was great.
Life.
And I think the reason there's not really that many similarities with these movies, but just the maybe the part with the music and the band and the way people gravitated to that.
Yeah.
I don't know. And maybe it's just Michael Paré and I'm just slamming those two things together.
Michael Paré was sleeveless in both of them. So, you know.
I mean, he looks great in both movies.
He does. He does.
Yeah. So you saw this when you were probably what? Like Streets of Fire. Let's go back
12,
to Streets of Fire.
12, 13. So, I mean, I was just a teenager when that came out.
So what do you think appealed to you the most about this kind of like rock and roll fable?
Yeah. I think it was just because it was just so unique to me, and it had elements of everything that I loved at the time. I loved rock and roll at the time. I was, like I said, I was a Springsteen fan. Not that this had Springsteen-esque music in it, but the music that it had from Ry Cooder, I love that steel guitar just sliding when you hear that. It sounded dangerous. Just the right amount of explosions, the right amount of revenge,
right.
You know, the right amount of comic relief, thanks to Rick Moranis. I was a big Rick Moranis fan at the time too. And he was great in this pompous little,
sorry to interrupt, but like,
no,
there's no way she's going for this guy. Like, no. What are you talking about? Like, but it's the classic.
It's like the Anna Nicole Smith
situation. Yes, it's like the classic guy that's the manager that's got the money and he's going to take her somewhere, you know, so she's got to like go with this guy.
Yeah, and it had Diane Lane too. And Diane Lane was, I mean, she was
Cherry
everywhere. Cherry Valance from The Outsiders.
She will always be Cherry Valance to me. Like, she's incredible.
She was in Rumblefish. She was, I mean,
oh,
I just.
Rumblefish is great too.
Loved Rumblefish.
Oh my
Francis
God.
Ford
that
Coppola's
is such a great movie.
It. Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, I everything that Diane Lane was in at the time, I was down for. So, like I said, it was just this perfect storm of all these little elements that I really enjoyed at the time individually coming together in one movie. And I was like, wow, this is it. This is, and
did it,
and
did it pull? Cause you know, for me, I'm watching it now. Right. And I'm noticing all the,
mistakes.
Well, not even I'm actually
misogyny.
Very forgiving, even if a bad, like a movie that might be seen as like a bad movie or something. I think all movies have something to offer.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of thinking about that this movie really is this like weird mashup of like a classic kind of love story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Obviously, there's some very romantic, you know, scenes. And also he kind of was very Bogart to me. Like, the guy that's like the good looking guy who's kind of like, I can't really stick around, you know, like he's really
has to ride off into the sunset. It's
really,
got a very Western vibe to it because he rides
it?
Off into a sunset
yes.
afterwards,
yes.
you know, and
so
it's a sad scene.
Whatever those things pull for you. But he did bring up that for me, that kind of feeling
totally.
Of this guy that's really unattainable, who's like
yeah.
very cool and very mysterious.
Detached,
you yep. know, it's classic. And of course her, she's, you know, there's points where she's, but what was I supposed to do in the rain? You know, exactly. The rain is dumping down, and I'm thinking, like, he's going to go through all of this, and then he's just going to walk away, you know, like typical.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, he was just a mercenary for hire, and that's all he wanted to do, and that's all he was, you know, charged to do. And that's what he did. And then he rode off into the sunset afterwards. And I mean, thankfully, it did have some of those, you know, more human attributes to him to overcoat the misogyny that came through. I mean, there's one scene where he just decks her right in the nose to knock her out.
I know. What the heck?
I know.
Crazy.
It's like, so I get it. It's almost like watching, you know, like 16 Candles or something these days. You know, you're like, oh God, that was really, really offensive.
I know. Well,
today. But that said, you know, it was, you know, there were these human qualities they had to him. And it's, again, it's by no means a great movie. It is just a movie that affected me. And I think that because it was this nondescript time frame that it was set in, I didn't feel as though I had to place them into real life characters. It was a cartoon. I mean, that's essentially
what
it was.
No, it really is. But it does have some pretty, like, the storytelling is there.
Yep.
Even though there's, like, the violence and the guy fights, you know, the throwing it down. It's hilarious in a lot of ways.
It is.
Like, he just walks in the town in the beginning, and he just, like, goes into a place and just beats the shit out of everyone.
One of the best scenes.
Which is such a plant and payoff that, you know, he can just kick, like, 20 people in a room, you know?
One of the best scenes in the entire movie is when he gets confronted by this group of thugs in the beginning. They're all, like, all decked out with their collars popped and everything. And he comes at him with a switchblade, and he grabs it and then just slaps the shit out of this guy, hands him the blade back, and says, "Try it again." I was like, that was just way too cool for words.
Try it again, Tony. Try it again, Tony.
That was so cool.
Right, so I do think this is interesting because, like, you're a kid that's a boy.
Yeah.
Not to stereotype boys and girls, but you're paying attention to, like, this guy who's representing this kind of, like, guy's guy, you know?
Manhood,
like,
but, yeah.
He's just, like, able to do it all and still be, like, sensitive, sort of, and, like, beautiful, and then do, like, this, you know, he's going to save the girl, you know? So he's got all the elements, I think, that maybe a lot of boys, like, if they're looking, like, oh man, this is it, you know, like kicking ass and like saving the girl, and this is like the thing. And then for me, I'm just watching all the female characters as I'm watching this, right? So that's my my view is through through the women's roles in this movie. But I'm still watching the guy stuff because it's awesome. I still love a good guy fight. I don't know why. I'm like weird like that.
Well,
I just do.
I was equally as in love with Amy Madigan's character, who was originally written for
She's
a male
great.
Role.
That Is that
a,
right?
Yeah. And they made the switch. Director Walter Hill made the switch and cast her in it. And she was fantastic. And it was interesting because, you know, in reflection and looking back on it, it was one of these, you know, subtle 80s style references to her being a lesbian, and it was one of those, you know, but they never actually were overt.
No,
because
I kept
80s.
Waiting, but then at some point she talks about being with a guy.
Yeah, and then she also, but
they
she
like
says,
pulled it out, and I was like, "Let her be
type.
Gay. What's the problem?"
But it was the given
right?
the time frame they
yeah,
had to. So
I know.
But when she's like, "You're not my type," and I'm like, "Oh my God!" It was so evident. I didn't, you know, you don't pick up on that when you're 12 years old, 13 years old, you know?
No, you don't. And those movies had characters like that all the time. I mean, for me, and this isn't, you know, I talk personally on this all the time. Like, I had no idea that I was going to be gay later in my life. Like, I had no clue. I was very into guys. I dated plenty of guys. I was married to a guy. And I used to love Some Kind of Wonderful because she
movie.
Had this
Jane
character
Jones.
That was so... kind of all over the place. Like, if you looked at her, she was kind of a tomboy.
Yep.
She was everything. And I kind of related to that a lot. I had a friend in high school that was exactly like her, who was guy crazy, but could play the drums and skateboard like nobody's business. And it was weird when I was growing up because I felt like people did get stereotyped. If you were that, you were this. And mm-hmm. I just thought that's Kim and that's this person. And that's like, I didn't really think about it that much.
Right. Yeah. And I think that was a product of its time, you know, it was a big thing for, you know, Rock Hudson at that time to come out as gay.
Oh,
you know what
God.
I mean?
So, crazy. Yeah.
So
yeah.
you think yeah. about just how they weren't able to live their truths, but I give them credit for making it mm-hmm. evident to those who could, so they could have somebody. So, you know, a young 14, 13, 12-year-old girl could watch this too and be like, yeah, I'm be comfortable with who she is. I just
right, or even
really
just
cool.
be a straight girl that's like, girls kick ass, fuck it. Like,
absolutely.
You don't need to be anything. Like, because that's so interesting to me, like in movies. Like, it used to be like, I don't know, like even in Aliens.
Yep.
There's the military.
Yeah.
And then there's what's her name?
Michelle
you know?
Rodriguez's
and
character.
And she's such a like tough yeah. dude, you know. But like, so
or
any
no, yeah,
stereotypes. But you know, I'll do this one little funny thing that I do. I kind of make these odd notes when I'm watching, when I'm rewatching a movie.
Do
and
it.
I'll just go through some of the things just for fun.
Uh-huh.
One of the first things I wrote was, there's a lot of hair flipping. Just a lot. There was a lot. When she was singing, it was like, there was this montage of her hair flipping that was awesome.
So
80s, right?
She like, was 18 at the time.
Was she really?
18 is
That's
when
crazy.
Diane Lane took that role.
Mm-hmm.
Her voice was actually a blend of two voices. So
I was like, was that her singing? I was going to ask that. I figured you
sing.
Might know. Yeah.
She didn't sing in it, but they took through the magic of computers at the time. And again, think about it. This is the 80s. They were able to blend two different vocals into one character, so into one singing voice. So, you know, that range that she had on there was mm-hmm. was the result of two separate different singers. I can't remember their names, but
I mean, all I could think of was Pat Benatar.
Yeah,
like that's
absolutely
all I thought of. I was like, this is so Pat Benatar,
yeah.
like everything she's doing.
Patti Smith, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, okay, that's
Laurie
what's happening.
Laurie Anderson a little bit, yeah.
Oh my God, it's so great.
Totally.
And I loved Pat Benatar.
But yes, a lot of hair flipping, you're right. And but,
so funny.
But beautiful Some of hair to flip. All of them had awesome hair, except maybe Amy Madigan's, because hers was under a hat most of the time.
I think that's just her hair in life.
But Rick Moranis had this beautiful, and Willem Dafoe had these beautiful pompadours that were just kind of...
did. Oh my God, Bill Paxton had some hair.
Bill Paxton was just
it was
yeah.
like amazing. It was like this...
Totally, he had like another head, he had another foot just in hair.
Awesome.
It was so cool.
It really
so
was.
So cool, yeah.
I wonder how much they love doing this movie, because this is like a fun movie to be in, right? Because you get to do all these crazy things.
Fun fact.
One
of the things, because again, my odd obsession with this film. So Michael Paré was one of his first roles too. And Rick Moranis was on, what had obviously been cast before he had. And Rick Moranis would constantly antagonize him. He said he hated working with Rick Moranis. Because he was always making jokes at his expense. He was always, you know, just cracking wise with him. And he said he just made it so uncomfortable for him. And Rick Moranis was actually just trying to get him, you know, kind of method acting to get him to hate him.
Oh, man.
So,
so funny.
But mission accomplished, man. He did his work there. But yeah, I mean, for everyone else, it had to have been the sets, everything. You just get to play in
yeah,
this.
And- Sorry.
Backlot. No, you get to play in this like surreal
world. I was
going
to say, it's such a set too. I mean, every
totally.
Single part of it was just like so obvious. But, and that's why it almost had like a musical feel. Even there was not really a musical going on, there
yeah.
was that look of like, that you, like you said, not, it's not any time or any place. It's just, this is what they came up with. This
right.
like kind of fantasy world. So another, I did write Bill Paxton's hair, exclamation points. I just thought that was awesome.
Oh my God, yeah.
And then I wrote, everyone is so upset. Like, I love in these movies, which did remind me of like Grease, or where the crowd is, there's no, we're only with the main characters and the crowds are such the crowds, right? Like
right.
the motorcycle gang is like almost one person. The audience of the show is like one person. And like when they take her, it's like all the shots of all the people are so upset. They're like, They're yeah. so upset. Like, I'm like, yeah. look at the reactions of the crowds. Like, and then the outfits would change mid-movie
yep.
where the crowds in the streets became more 80s. Did you notice that?
Totally. It was during yeah. that one particular scene where right. That scene almost felt like it wasn't part of the movie. It felt like it was shot as a music video.
Oh, yeah.
In and of itself. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, because it just started to, that's when the neon really started to pop. That's when the dress really became this like weird mixture of the two, and you saw the true 80s-ness of the film in that particular scene. So it felt as yeah. though that was almost like a music video that was meant to accompany it. I have no idea.
No, and the movie kind of, just like those old movies do, break into moments where it kind of is a music video.
Totally.
You know,
absolutely.
Where there's a song happening. There's like a montage, a visual thing where people are walking through it. And but yeah, and that's like, I think, such a telling signature of that time period in filmmaking.
And another, yeah, yeah, like I Can Dream About You, you know, when they came on. And that was actually a hit as well.
I was like, the second I heard it, I was like, that's such a great song.
Yeah, Dan Hartman, I believe, was the singer, who's a white guy. But it was Stoney Jackson was the lead of this, you know, this doo-wop group, who all black doo-wop group, who was supposed to sing that. But it also talked about the, you know, that was the other good thing. Like, it, not good thing, but it brought up racism in there too, just a tad
right,
bit.
Right, you're right.
So,
they did, yeah.
You know, I mean, it was a pretty progressive film.
It was trying, definitely, yeah. And there was all that Motown, Mount, like you said, the Motown vibe was mm-hmm. happening a lot with the, like, you know, the backup dance singers.
Yeah.
And, so there was that. But my God, another funny thing. I write the most like not intelligent. I wrote, there's so much slapping in the diner fight. Slap fights are gone.
Yep.
I had a joke with Tom. We were talking about, you'll like this. We were talking about, what's that movie with Daniel Day-Lewis?
Streets.
No, that really, oh my God. What the heck can't I think
of
it now? No, it's like the oil.
There Will Be Blood.
There Will Be Blood. And he just slap fights the hell out of that guy down to the ground.
I drink your milkshake.
Yes. And I'm thinking like, oh my God, I forgot about slapping. Like yeah. nobody slaps in movies anymore.
No.
It doesn't happen at all.
At the end of a barrel. Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, can't we bring back a slap fight? Does it have to be guns all the time?
And that was
so
the
great.
Perfect. That's why I loved that one scene where he just slaps the hell out of the guy.
It's
and
awesome.
Then hands him his knife back. He says, try it again.
I know. Please, everyone listening, bring back slap fights.
Yeah, really.
In fact, I really think I need to see more
so
of them.
So much more civilized.
It really is. You don't even need a weapon. Just
no.
slap somebody down.
Exactly.
It's really
just
upsetting.
Back your hand.
I think it's more upsetting than if you hit somebody any other way.
It's more personal.
It really is.
You know,
it's
that physicality of it. Yeah, exactly.
So crazy. So I wrote, yeah, so much slap fighting. my favorite. And I also wrote that I love the suspender thing. Because, like, his pants are not going to fall down, okay? Like, he is fit, that guy. He's
and
got the suspenders
They're
on.
Plastic. I mean, it looks like this, like, leather or plastic mix.
Right,
so.
But I just meant, like, yeah. What's his name? Michael Paré's character.
Oh, him, yeah.
Because he's got the old-fashioned,
oh my God. Yes,
high-waisted,
one.
and then the super fit. He's always shirtless, and then there's a couple scenes where he's so, you know, showing off his body, and he's got the suspenders, and I'm thinking,
there's yeah.
you don't need those
there's
at
no
all.
Need.
Like
yeah.
you're just those are just. But it's funny to me
because
I'm like, what's
if he
up
were
with
to
that?
Flex, those suspenders would pop right off. I'm pretty
so,
sure.
I mean, listen, it's a very cool look. I'm a big fan of suspenders. But
I'm guessing it was probably because it was again when we talk about the 50s and 80s. You know, the mixture of the two. Because really, if you think about it, in the 80s is when suspenders was back in. You had, you know, Mork and Mindy.
Oh, you're right.
You had Wall Street.
Oh my
with,
God, Mork and Mindy
with. Michael Douglas was wearing the suspenders as Gordon Gekko. So, you know.
No,
there was,
you're right. Okay. I get it.
It was probably a resurgence in the trend that, you know, harkened back to that time.
Yeah. And he's, I mean, we haven't even really talked about the story, but we're just having fun with this one. I love that he whips out the old photo of her, and it's such an old photo.
Right.
Now it's like we're in the 30s or so. I don't know what time period it is. Now
yeah.
she's looking at, like, it's almost like war, you
black
know?
And white, crinkled. Exactly. It was
yeah.
almost like it was in his tent while he was, you
yeah.
know, stationed overseas, and that's what kept him going all these years.
Right, because he was in the war. He was in the military.
Exactly. Yep.
And so was, what's her name?
Amy Madigan's
Amy
character.
Amy Madigan
yeah.
was also, so yep. another props to women fighting.
Yep.
Being in the military.
Yep.
And there's great one-liners. I wish I would have written them all down. They're amazing. she says something like, are we going to do it or are we going to talk about it? Like, yeah. There's just, and that's just one thing that I wrote down, but there's like a lot of funny, just
throwaway one-liners.
Yes. Yes. Just like awesome one-liners.
A lot of them courtesy of Rick Moranis or with right? Rick Moranis. I mean, he was really good because he was like this really, you know, motor-mouthed, Napoleonic, manager for her. So, he would often, what he lacked in stature, he would try to make up for in his words. And, he had a lot of good ones at the expense, but then it would always come back to haunt him. Like, he would always be the one who would end up being the butt of those jokes.
Right.
So.
And actually, look, I was able to just pull up a bunch of them.
There you go.
McCoy says it one. I'll just read a couple funny quotes here.
McCoy being Amy Madigan's.
Yes, guy. McCoy. You know, everywhere I go, there's always an asshole.
Yeah. That was to Bill Paxton. That Bill Paxton was giving her shit when she was ordering her drink at, not Torchy's, but whatever the bar was. But yes, yep.
Oh, man. And some of them are just cheesy. Like when Tom, this is just a Tom saying, which is Michael, to Ellen, who is
mm-hmm.
Diane.
Ellen Aim.
Look, I know you're going to be going places with your singing and stuff, and I'm not the kind of guy to be carrying your guitars around for you, but if you ever need me for something, I'll be there.
I'll be there.
I'll be there.
Yeah. Yep.
Man.
I'm total, you know, Western or dude conversation to have, you know. I mean, it's just there's so much that you could kind of pick apart, and especially with the retrospective lens of 2020, you know, looking back on it, it is, you know, it's certainly far from perfect, but you know, there was just enough in there. If you are able to just kind of just place yourself back in that simpler time and really just let that nostalgia kind of flood over you, there's a lot to enjoy in that movie.
It's great. So I guess what I should ask is, is there anything deep for this movie for you? Or is it just, like you said, like a warm, cozy?
That's it.
That's enough.
You know, there are movies that have affected me. There are movies that mm-hmm. I was like, wow, this is the power of cinema. This is where things are going to go. This is the direction. This is, you know,
yeah.
Memento with its writing.
Oh my
and
God,
its
I remember
nonlinear
when that came
structure.
Out.
I mean,
that
there's
was awesome.
So
yeah.
many that I could probably point to. And, you know, I remember the first time seeing The Matrix in the theater and realizing, oh my God, this just completely just shattered my world. You know, I mean, Fight Club, you know, there's a
so
ton
many
of them,
I know,
but this one for me is just one of those that, you know, it doesn't take much to, you can join it at any time and just, you know, like I said, let the nostalgia wash over you and just not it doesn't take any deeper meaning. It doesn't take any, you know, philosophy degree. You know, there's no, you know, cave parable in there or anything. It's simple. But yet it was just a mm-hmm. combination of all these things that just worked.
Yeah, and I think for me it's just the love of Michael Paré and like then yeah. wanting to slide right into like double feature with Eddie and the Cruisers. Just and it's funny, I've been talking a lot about myself on here, and I've been noticing when we talk about looking at the past and looking at the movies that you really liked, I'm such a true crime junkie as currently in my life, and I'm very into any movie that's about like murder, crimes, whatever, you
right,
know, like
right.
Silence is up there. I literally just binged Hannibal on Netflix because I couldn't help myself, even
nice.
Though it's so gross.
Yeah.
By the way, that movie, I cannot believe
oh,
these
the
shows.
Movie.
Are,
I
no,
you,
no, sorry, the
show.
TV show. The TV show, which is now
it's
on
phenomenal.
Netflix. Did you watch the whole thing?
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
Are they going to bring four? Because
no, I don't think
fuck.
So. Yeah, I know.
Damn it!
I know.
Because they brought it right up to Manhunter.
So good.
And read the Red Dragon story, which I think they did a really good job of.
And Manhunter's
sorry if we've
another
lost
one.
You people.
Manhunter's another one. I mean, that was...
great
talk about
movie.
Comfort food. That and To Live and Die in L.A. There were two that starred William Peterson back in that time frame. And I loved both of them. Michael Mann. I
yeah.
watched anything Michael Mann did because he was such an amazing visual director. And yeah, it was that was just such a great, great movie. The scene where have you seen the movie?
I have. I've seen all of the stuff. I'm like totally into all that stuff. Yeah.
When he comes down and, you know, set ablaze on the wheelchair, the one reporter there, the tough talking reporter.
Oh my God.
Who was actually, he was the guy from Avatar. who went on to the big
is that right?
Jacked up Marine in Avatar. That was him.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, I can't remember the actor's name.
That's just a plug for that show if you can handle it. It's very
oh yeah.
It's gross. Yeah. I don't have another word for it. It's not even violent. It's just like
it's icky. It's kind under of your
a
skin, lot icky.
Yeah, which I loved how they did it. I thought it had a Lynchian vibe to me too.
Totally.
I should do a whole other episode on that alone because I was writing my friend Steve texting while I was watching. I'm like, this is so David Lynch. Like, what is happening with the show? The styles and like the weird.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm getting at with this movie is that I think I'm realizing more and more why I liked certain movies when I was young. And I think I liked Eddie and the Cruiser so much because it had so much of everything. It had like a mystery. It had like kind of like a cold case where they're trying to like figuring it out current day, but then there's the past.
Yep.
And they're pulling up all the past, and then they're finding the new the characters now and where they've been. And so it had all these, and plus it had like a little bit of a love story. It had
rock and roll.
Yep. Oh my God, it had everything. And these movies have, like you said, they just are
there's not
comfort
a,
for that reconnecting. And I think we all are kind of in this quarantine looking for our like, you know, our favorite blanket or whatever kind of cuddly thing we need to comfort ourselves from the reality.
To bring us back to a simpler time in our minds, just to slow our minds down, because we have this deluge of information that we're getting each and every day. Things change, and, you know, the lack of social connection. So, you know, the more that you can find that takes you back to when things were simple and you didn't have the cares of the modern world and you weren't looking at, you know, mortgages and debt and so on and so forth.
Oh man,
you know?
Just Streets of Fire. Just
so seriously, just
seriously,
you know,
take me away.
Yeah, and I didn't have to, you know, rethink.
I love it.
And you know, so yeah.
Yeah, you don't think too much.
No,
yeah.
You
I think
don't
sometimes
have to.
You don't want to think too much right now.
Nope.
Well, listen, this has been. I always ask people. I think you kind of already said it. Favorite scene.
Yeah, it would. I mean, there's several of them.
Yeah.
You know, the iconic one of Willem Dafoe when he screams and starts the sledgehammer fight in the holds the siren in his hand, and
that's a great scene.
Such a good scene. But really, I mean, opening it up and you have this group of guys who are just dudded up in their 50s glamour, pants rolled up. Like I said, collars popped, leather jackets, and they're approaching this soul guy who's just sitting there and minding his own business, having a cup of coffee, and he proceeds to pound the piss out of all of them and humiliate them, and it was great. And that was during the opening credits.
It really is, you're right.
That was so cool because it would stop halfway through, like him throwing somebody out the window. It would freeze frame, and then it would say, you know, written by Walter Hill, and then it would go back into regular motion again. It was just
awesome.
That was so cool.
All right, well, I loved a lot of things in this, so that the slap fight I think still is my favorite. That scene is also really good, and I did like the sledgehammer fight. That was pretty cool.
Yeah,
I also like the scene where they go into this decrepit this area that's so scary,
right,
that they have to go into to get her.
Yep.
Which I
and
thought,
torches.
I didn't even think it was that. I was like, this isn't even scary. What's going on?
No, but it was industrial.
There's nothing scary about
it.
Yeah,
if Ed Begley is the scariest person.
And then he comes out of the woodwork, and I'm like, he's amazing. This is the best scene ever, this guy. Like, it's
great.
So funny. Just all of it. But there, you know, there's a lot of gems in this. And I guess I don't think I have anything else to share except just everybody find your comfort movie right now if you need to. And if you need to talk about it, message me. You can come on and we can discuss your childhood, whatever you need to get out.
Right?
Do it in the form of a film review.
It's a cinematic therapy session.
It's movie therapy, really.
Right?
It kind of is. A movie confessional. I almost called it that.
Totally.
All right. Well, Rob, thank you so much for coming.
Jeff, always a pleasure.
And if you want to be a reoccurring, if you have time, maybe we can dig up some other movies.
I got plenty.
I'm sure you do. I love it. And everyone go to Jaws Fest if you can. Support the cause. And don't be afraid of COVID. It's okay.
We're going to get through this. It's just going to take some adjusting and just do what the doctors say. That's all. Just follow the doctor's lead.
Follow the goddamn rules, people.
Right?
Wear your mask.
Social
saying
distance.
It.
Yeah.
I don't care. That's it.
Yep.
All right. Peace out, everybody. I'll see you next time.
Bye.
Dream.